Side 19. Gravity's Rainbow by Thomas Pynchon. Continuing on page 668. Both of them are dripping with dew. He follows her on down to the stream, takes off the mask again, and throws water at his face while she drinks beside him, slurping, placid. The water is clear, running lively, cold. Round rocks knock together under the stream, a resonant sound, a music. It would be worth something to sit day and night in and out, listening to these sounds of water and cobbles unfold. Slothop is hungry. Come on, we got to find breakfast. Beside a small pond near a farmhouse, the pig discovers a wood stake driven into the ground. She begins snuffling around it. Slothrop kicks aside loose earth and finds a brick cairn stuffed with potatoes and siled last year. Fine for you, as she falls too eagerly, but I can't eat that stuff. Sky is shining in the calm surface of the water. Nobody seems to be around. Slothrop wanders off to check the farmhouse. Tall white daisies grow all over the yard. Thatch-hooded windows upstairs are dark, no smoke comes from the chimneys. But the chicken house in back is occupied. He eases a big, fat white hen up off of her nest, reaches gingerly for the eggs. Pecaw! She flies into a dither, tries to peck Slothrop's arm off. Friends come shooting in from outside, raising a god-awful commotion, at which point the hen has worked her wings through the wood slats so she can't get back in and is too fat below the wing pits to get the rest of the way out. So, there she hangs, flapping and screaming, while Slothrop grabs three eggs, then tries to push her wings back inside for her. It is a frustrating job, especially trying to keep the eggs balanced. The rooster is in the doorway, hollering, Achtung! Achtung! Discipline in his harem is shot to hell. Noisy white tumbleweed hens are barrel-assing all over the inside of the coop, and blood is flowing from Slothrop in half a dozen places. Then he hears a dog barking. Time to give up on this hen. Comes outside, sees a lady in her Wehrmacht auxiliary outfit 30 meters away leveling a shotgun, and the dog charging in, growling, teeth bared, eyes on Slothrop's throat. Slothrop goes scrambling around the henhouse just as the gun kicks off a good morning blast. About then, the pig shows up and chases off the dog. Away they go, eggs cradled in pig mask, lady yelling, hens raising hell, pig galloping along beside. There's a final shotgun blast, but by then, they're out of range. About a mile farther on, they pause for Slothrop's breakfast. Good show, thumping the pig affectionately. She crouches, catching her breath, gazing at him while he eats raw eggs and smokes half a cigarette. Then they set off again. Soon they have begun to angle toward the sea. The pig seems to know where she's going. Far away on another road, a great cloud of dust hangs, crawling southward, maybe a Russian horse convoy. Fledgling storks are trying out their wings over the haystacks and fields. Tops of solitary trees are blurred green, as if smudged accidentally by a sleeve. Brown windmills turn at the horizon, across miles of straw-sprinkled red earth. A pig is a jolly companion, boar, sow, barrow, or gilt. A pig is a pal who'll boost your morale, though mountains may topple and tilt. When they've blackballed, bamboozled, and burned you, when they've turned on you Taurian wig, though you may be thrown over by tabby or rover, you'll never go wrong with a pig. A pig, you'll never go wrong with a pig. By nightfall, they have entered a wooded stretch. Fog drifts in the hollows. A lost, unmilked cow complains somewhere in the darkness. The pig and Slothrop settled down to sleep among pines thick with shreds of tinfoil, a cloud of British window dumped to fox the German radars in some long-ago raid, a whole forest of Christmas trees, tinsel rippling in the wind, catching the starlight, silent, ice-cold crown fire, acres wild over their heads all night. Slothrop keeps waking to find a pig snuggled in a bed of pine needles, watching over him. It's not for danger, or out of restlessness. Maybe she's decided Slothrop needs looking after. In the tinfoil light, she's very sleek and convex. Her bristles look smooth as down. Lustful thoughts come filtering into Slothrop's mind. Little peculiarity here, you know. Nothing he can't handle. They fall asleep under the decorated trees. The pig a wandering eastern magus. Slothrop in his costume a gaudy present waiting for morning and a child to claim him. Next day, about noon, they enter a slow-withering city alone on the Baltic coast and perishing from an absence of children. The sign over the city gate in burned bulbs and empty sockets reads, Zwölfkinder. The great wheel dominating the skyline for miles out of town leans a little askew. Grim old governess, sun catching long streaks of rust, sky pale through the iron lattice that droops its long twisted shadow across the sand and into the plum sea. Wind cat howls in and out the doorless halls and houses. Frida? A voice calling from the blue shadow behind a wall. Grunting, smiling, the pig stands her ground. Look who I brought home. Soon a thin, freckled man, blonde, nearly bald, steps out into the sun. Glancing at Slothrop, nervous, he reaches to scratch Frida between the ears. I am Perkler. Thank you for bringing her back. No, no, she brought me. Yes. Perkler is living in the basement of the town hall. He has some coffee heating on a driftwood fire in the stove. Do you play chess? Frida kibitzes. Slothrop, who tends to play more by superstition than strategy, is obsessed with protecting his knights, springer and springer, willing to lose anything else, thinking no more than a move or two ahead, if that. He alternates long, lethargic backing and filling with bursts of idiot razzle-dazzle that have Perkler frowning, but not with worry. About the time Slothrop loses his queen... Say, wait a minute. Did you say Perkler? Zip, the man is out with a Luger as big as a house. Really fast guy, with the muzzle pointing right at Slothrop's head. For a moment, Slothrop, in his pig suit, thinks that Perkler thinks that he, Slothrop, has been fooling around with Frida the pig, and that there is about to be a shotgun or Luger wedding here. In fact, the phrase, "Unto thee I pledge my troth," has just arrived in his brain when he realizes that what Perkler is actually saying is, "You'd better leave. Only two more moves, and I'd have had you anyway." Let me at least tell you my story. Slithering fast as he can the Zurich information with Perkler's name on it, the Russian-American Herrero search for the Escaret, wondering meantime, in parallel sort of, if that Oberst Enzian wasn't right about going native in the zone, beginning to get ideas fixed and slightly, erotic notions about destiny. Are you Slothrop, eh? Tracing back the route Frida the pig brought him along, trying to remember forks where they might have turned another way. The Schwarzgerät. Perkler shakes his head. I don't know what it was. I was never that interested. Is that really all you're after? Slothrop thinks that over. Their coffee cups take sunlight from the window and bounce it back up to the ceiling, bobbing ellipses of blue light. Don't know, except for this kind of personal tie-in with Emipolex G. It's an aromatic polyamide, Perkler putting the gun back in his shirt. Tell me about it, says Slothrop. Well, but not before he has told something of his Ilse and her summer returns, enough for Slothrop to be taken again by the nape and pushed against Bianca's dead flesh. Ilse, fathered on Greta Erdmann's silver and passive image, Bianca conceived during the filming of the very scene that was in his thoughts as Perkler pumped in the fatal charge of sperm. How could they not be the same child? She's still with you, though harder to see these days. Nearly invisible as a glass of gray lemonade in a twilit room. Still she is there, cool and acid and sweet, waiting to be swallowed down to touch your deepest cells, to work among your saddest dreams. Perkler does manage to tell a little about Laszlo Jampf, but keeps getting sidetracked off into talking about the movies, German movies Slothrop has never heard of, much less seen. Yes, here's some kind of fanatical movie hound, all right. On D-Day, he confesses, when I heard General Eisenhower on the radio announcing the invasion of Normandy, I thought it was really Clark Gable. Have you ever noticed the voices are identical? In the last third of his life, there came over Laszlo Jampf, so it seemed to those who from out in the wood lecture halls watched his eyelids slowly granulate, spots and wrinkles grow across his image, disintegrating it toward old age, a hostility. A strangely personal hatred for the covalent bond. A conviction that, for synthetics to have a future at all, the bond must be improved on. Some students even read transcended. That something so mutable, so soft, as a sharing of electrons by atoms of carbon should lie at the core of life, his life, struck Jampf as a cosmic humiliation. Sharing? How much stronger, how everlasting was the ionic bond where electrons are not shared but captured, seized and held, polarized, plus and minus, these atoms, no ambiguities. How he came to love that clarity, how stable it was, such mineral stubbornness. Whatever lip service we may pay to reason, he told Perkler's class back at the TH, to moderation and compromise, nevertheless there remains the lion. A lion in each one of you. He is either tamed by too much mathematics, by details of design, by corporate procedures, or he stays wild, an eternal predator. The lion does not know subtleties and half solutions. He does not accept sharing as a basis for anything. He takes, he holds. He is not a Bolshevik or a Jew. You will never hear relativity from the lion. He wants the absolute life and death, win and lose. Not truces or arrangements, but the joy of the leap, the roar of the blood. If this be National Socialist chemistry, blame that something in the air, the zeitgeist. Sure, blame it. Professor Dr. Jampf was not immune, neither was his student Perkler. But through inflation and depression, Perkler's idea of the lion came to have a human face attached to it, a movie face, natürlich, that of the actor Rudolf Kleinroger, whom Perkler idolized and wanted to be like. Kleinroger was carrying nubile actresses off to rooftops when King Kong was still on the tit, with no motor skills to speak of. Well, one nubile actress anyway, Brigitte Helm in Metropolis. Great movie. Exactly the world Perkler and evidently quite a few others were dreaming about those days. A corporate city-state, where technology was the source of power. The engineer worked closely with the administrator, the masses labored unseen, far underground, and ultimate power lay with a single leader at the top. Fatherly and benevolent and just, who wore magnificent-looking suits and whose name Perkler couldn't remember, being too taken with Kleinroger playing the mad inventor that Perkler and his co-disciples under Jampf longed to be, indispensable to those who ran the metropolis, yet at the end, the untamable lion, who could let it all crash. Girl, state, masses, himself, asserting his reality against them all in one last roaring plunge from rooftop to street. A curious potency. Whatever it was the real visionaries were picking up out of the hard tessitura of those days in city streets, whatever Käthe Kollwitz saw that brought her lean death down to hump its women from behind, and they to love it so, seemed now and then to have touched Perkler too, in his deeper excursions into the Mare Nocturnum. He found delight not unlike a razor sweeping his skin and nerves, scalp to soles, in ritual submissions to the master of this night space and of himself, the male embodiment of a technologique that embraced power not for its social uses, but for just those chances of surrender, personal and dark surrender to the void, to delicious and screaming collapse. To Attila the Hun, as a matter of fact, come west out of the steppes to smash the precious structure of magic and incest that held together the kingdom of the Burgundians. Perkler was tired that night, all day out scavenging for coal. He kept falling asleep, waking to images that for half a minute he could make no sense of at all. A close-up of a face, a forest, the scales of the dragon, a battle scene. Often enough, it would resolve into Rudolf Kleinroger, ancient oriental thanatomaniac Attila, head shaved except for a topknot, bead strung, raving with grandiloquent gestures and those enormous bleak eyes. Perkler would nod back into sleep with bursts of destroying beauty there for his dreams to work on, speaking barbaric gutturals for the silent mouths, smoothing the Burgundians into something of the meekness, the grayness of certain crowds in the beer halls back at the TH. And wake again, it went on for hours, into some further progression of carnage, of fire and smashing. On the way home, by tram and foot, his wife bitched at Perkler for dozing off, ridiculed his engineer's devotion to cause and effect. How could he tell her that the dramatic connections were really all there in his dreams? How could he tell her anything? Kleinroger is remembered most of all for his role as Dr. Mabuse. You were meant to think of Ugo Stinnes, the tireless operator behind the scenes of apparent inflation, apparent history, gambler, financial wizard, arch-gangster, a fuzzy burgerlich mouth, jowls, graceless moves, the first impression of comic technocracy. And yet, when the rages came over him, breaking through from beneath the rationalized look with his glacial eyes become windows into the bare savanna, then the real Mabuse surfaced, vital and proud against the gray forces surrounding him, edging him toward the doom he must have known he couldn't escape, the silent inferno of guns, grenades, streets full of troops attacking his headquarters, and his own madness at the end of the secret tunnel. And who brought him down but matinee idol Bernhard Goetzke, estate prosecutor von Wenck, Irtzka, who played tender, wistful, bureaucratic death in Der Müde Tod, here too running true to form, too tame, too gentle for the jaded countess he coveted. But Klein Rogge jumped in, with all claws out, drove her effeminate husband to suicide, seized her, threw her on his bed, the languid bitch, took her, while gentle Gürtzke sat in his office, among his papers and sybarites, Mabuza trying to hypnotize him, drug him, bomb him to death in his own office. Nothing worked. Each time the great Weimar inertia, files, hierarchies, routines, kept saving him. Mabuza was the savage throwback, the charismatic flash no Sunday afternoon aqua plate could ever bear. The print through the rippling solution, each time flaring up to the same annihilating white. Piscean depths, Berkler has cruised, dream and waking, beneath him images of everyday inflation, dreariness, queues, stockbrokers, boiled potatoes in a dish, searching with only gills and gut, some nervous drive toward myth he doesn't even know if he believes in, for the white light, ruins of Atlantis, intimations of a truer kingdom. Metropolitan inventor Rotwang, King Attila, Mabuza, Der Spieler, Professor Dr. Laszlo Jampf, all their yearnings aimed the same way, toward a form of death that could be demonstrated to hold joy and defiance. Nothing of bourgeois Gürtzkian death, of self-deluding, mature acceptance, relatives in the parlor, knowing faces the children can always read. "You have the two choices," Jampf cried, his last lecture of the year. Outside were the flowery strokings of wind, girls in pale-colored dresses, oceans of beer, male choruses intensely, movingly lifted as they sang, "Semper sit in flores, semper sit in flores. Stay behind with carbon and hydrogen. Take your lunch bucket into the works every morning with the faceless droves who can't wait to get in out of the sunlight or move beyond. Silicon, boron, phosphorus, these can replace carbon and can bond to nitrogen instead of hydrogen." A few snickers here, not unanticipated by the playful old pedagogue, be he always in flower. His involvement in getting Weimar to subsidize the IG's Stickstoff Syndikat was well known. Move beyond life, toward the inorganic. Here is no frailty, no mortality. Here is strength and the timeless. Then his well-known finale, as he wiped away the scrawled C-H on his chalkboard and wrote in enormous letters, S-I-H. N. The wave of the future. But Jampf himself, oddly, did not move on. He never synthesized those new inorganic rings or chains he had prophesied so dramatically. Had he only remained behind in the trough, academic generations swelling away just ahead, or had he known something Perkler and the others didn't? Were his exhortations in the lecture hall some kind of eccentric joke? He stayed with C-H and took his lunch bucket to America. Perkler lost touch with him after the Technische Hochschule. So did all his old pupils. He was now under the sinister influence of Lyle Bland, and if he was still seeking to escape the mortality of the covalent bond, Jampf was doing it in the least obvious way there was. If that Lyle Bland hadn't joined the Masons, he'd still probably be up to those nefarious tricks of his. Just as there are in the world machineries committed to injustice as an enterprise, so too there seem to be provisions active for balancing things out once in a while. Not as an enterprise exactly, but at least in the dance of things. The Masons, in the dance of things, turned out to be one of these where Bland was concerned. Imagine the fellow's plight. Got so much money, he don't know what to do with it all. Don't go screaming, give it to me, either. He's given it to you, though in roundabout ways you might need a good system of search to unsnarl. Oh, has he given it to you, by way of the Bland Institute and the Bland Foundation? The man has had his meat hooks well into the American day-to-day since 1919. Who do you think sat on top of the patent for that 100 miles per gallon carburetor, eh? Sure, you've heard that story. Maybe even snickered along with paid anthropologists who called it automotive age myth or some shit. Well, turns out the item was real, all right, and it was Lyle Bland who sprang for those academic hookers doing the snickering and the credentialed lying. Or how about the great killer weed advertising campaign of the 30s? Who do you think worked hand in glove, or as grosser individuals have put it, penis in mouth, with the FBI on that one? And remember all those guy goes to the doctor, can't get a hard-on jokes? planted by Bland. Yep, half a dozen basic variations after having done depth studies for the National Research Council that indicated an unacceptable 36% of the male workforce wasn't paying enough attention to their cocks. Not enough genital obsession there. And it was undermining the efficiency of the organs doing the real work. Psychological studies became, in fact, a Bland specialty. His probe into the subconscious of early depression America is considered a classic and widely credited with improving the plausibility of Roosevelt's election in 1932. Though many of his colleagues found a posture of hatred for FDR useful, Bland was too delighted to go through the motions. For him, FDR was exactly the man. Harvard, beholden to all kinds of money, old and new, commodity and retail, Harriman and Weinberg, an American synthesis, which had never occurred before, and which opened the way to certain grand possibilities, all grouped under the term control, which seemed to be a private code word, more in line with the aspirations of Bland and others. A year later, Bland joined the Business Advisory Council, set up under Swope of General Electric, whose ideas on matters of control ran close to those of Walter Rathenau of German GE. Whatever Swope's outfit did, it did in secret. Nobody got to see its files. Bland wasn't about to tell anybody either. He had gotten to be buddies after World War I with the Office of the Alien Property Custodian. Their job was to dispose of confiscated German interests in the U.S. A lot of Midwestern money was involved here, which is what got Bland embroiled in the great pinball difficulty, and so into the Masons. Seems that through something called the Chemical Foundation, cover names in those days had no style to them, the APC had sold Bland a few of Laszlo Jamp's early patents, along with the U.S. agency of Guitherius Paint and Dye, a Berlin firm. A few years later, in 1925, in the course of being put together, the IG bought back 50% of American Guitherius from Bland, who was using his end of it as a patent-holding company. Bland got cash, securities, and controlling interest in a Guitherius subsidiary in Berlin being run by a Jew named Flaumbaum. Yes, yes, the same Flaumbaum Frank Perkler worked for, till the place burned down and Perkler went back out on the streets. Indeed, there were those who could see Bland's hand in that disaster, though the Jew got blamed, fucked under by the courts, attached till he was bankrupt, and, in the fullness of time, sent east along with many others of his race. We would also have to show some interlock between Bland and the UFA movie distribution people who sent Perkler out with his advertising bills to Reinickendorf that night to his fateful meeting with Kurt Montaugen and the Verein für Raumschifffahrt, now to mention separate connections for Achtfaden, Nerisch, and the other Escheret people, before we'd have a paranoid structure worthy of the name. Alas, the state of the art by 1945 was nowhere near adequate to that kind of data retrieval. Even if it had been, Bland or his successors and assigns could have bought programmers by the truckload to come in and make sure all the information fed out was harmless. Those like Slothrop, with the greatest interest in discovering the truth, were thrown back on dreams, psychic flashes, omens, cryptographies, drug epistemologies, all dancing on a ground of terror, contradiction, absurdity. After the Flaumbaum fire, lines of power among Bland and his German colleagues had to be renegotiated. It dragged on for a few years. Bland found himself in depression in St. Louis, talking with one Alfonso Tracy, Princeton 06, St. Louis Country Club, moving into petrochemicals in a big way. Mrs. Tracy, dithering in and out of the house with yardage and armloads of flowers, preparing for the annual Veiled Prophet Ball, Tracy himself preoccupied with the appearance of some individuals down from Chicago in flashy pinstripe suits, two-tone shoes, and snap-brim fedoras, all talking in accents staccato as a Thompson. "Oh, do I need a good electronics man," Tracy moaned. "What do you do with these wops? The whole shipment was bad, and now they won't take it back. If I step out of line, they'll murder me. They'll rape Mabel. They'll go back to Princeton some dark night, and castrate my kid. You know what I think it is, Lyle? A plot. Vendettas, jeweled gauntlets, subtle poisons come infiltrating this well-mannered parlor with the picture of Herbert Hoover on the piano, the pinks and the Neiman Marcus bowl, the Bauhaus-style furniture like alabaster slabs of a model city. You expect little H.O. trains to come whirring out from under the Davenport, cans and reefers on and on across the carpet's ash-colored lowland. Alfonso Tracy's long face, creased either side of the nose and on around the mustache line, dragged down by worries 30 years without a genuine smile. Even Laurel and Hardy doesn't work for me anymore. Morose with fright in his easy chair. How could Lyle Bland not be touched?
"Got just the fella," says he, touching Tracy's arm, compassionate. "Always good to have an engineer on tap. This one did some just top-notch electronic surveillance designs once for the then-fledgling FBI. On a contract, the Bland Institute landed a few years ago and subbed part of out to Siemens over there in Germany. Have him in tomorrow on the Silver Streak, no problem, Al." "Come on out and have a look," sighs Tracy. They hop in the Packard and drive out to the green little river town of Mouth Organ, Missouri, which is a railroad station, a tanning factory, a few frame houses, and dominating the area, a gigantic Masonic hall. Not a window on the whole massive monolith. After a lot of rigmarole at the door, Bland is finally allowed in and led through velvet pool rooms, elaborate polished wood gambling setups, chrome bars, soft bedrooms, onto a large warehouse section in back, which is crammed 10 high... with more pinball machines than Bland's ever seen in one place in his life. Oh, boys, Grand Slams, World Serieses, Lucky Lindy's, as far as the eye can reach. "And every one is fucked up," says melancholy Tracy. "Look at this. It's a Folie Bergère, four-color lovelies doing the can-can all over it, zeros happening to coincide with eyes, nipples, and cunts. One of your racy-type games here, a little hostile toward the ladies, but all in fun. You got a nickel?" Chong, boing, there goes the ball, just missing a high-scoring hole. Looks like a permanent warp there. Honk, knocks a flasher worth 1,000, but only 50 lights up on the board. "You see?" Tracy screams as the ball heads like a rock for the bottom. Outside chance to get with a flipper. Zong, flipper flips the other fucking way, and the board lights up tilt. "Tilt?" Bland, scratching his head. "You didn't even..." "They're all like that," Tracy watering with frustration. "You try it." The second ball isn't even out of the chute before Bland gets another tilt again without having applied any English. Third ball gets stuck somehow against a solenoid and help, help, it's hollering, wounded, high little voice. "Oh, I'm being electrocuted." Ding, 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 gongs and racing numbers up on the board. 400,000, 675,000, bong, 1,000,000. Greatest Folie Bergère score in history and climbing. The poor spherical soul against the solenoid, thrashing, clonic, horrible. Yes, they're sentient, all right, beings from the planetoid Kochspiel of very, very elliptical orbit, which is to say it passed by Earth only once a long time ago, nearly back at the grainy crepuscular edge, and nobody knows where Kochspiel is now or when or if it'll be back. It's that familiar division between return and one-shot visitation. If Kochspiel had enough energy to leave the sun's field forever, then it has left these kind, round beings in eternal exile with no chance of ever being gathered back home, doomed to masquerade as ball bearings, as steelies in 1,000 marble games, to know the great thumbs of Keokuk and Puyallup, Oyster Bay, Inglewood, Danny D'Alessandro and Elmer Ferguson, Pee-wee Brennan and Flash Womack. Where are they now? Where do you think? They all got drafted. Some are dead on Hewell, some gangrenous in the snow in the forest of Arden. And their thumbs, first rifle inspection in basic, GI'd, driven deep back into childhood as little finger sweat cams off M1 operating handle. Thumb pushing down, follower still deep in breach, bolt, shock. Wax thumb, oh shit, yes, it hurts. And goodbye to another unbeatable and legendary thumb, gone for good back to the summer dust. Bags of chuckling glass, big-footed basset hounds, smell of steel playground slides heating in the sun. Well, here come these can-can girls now. Folie Bergère menads, moving in for the kill. Big lipstick smiles around blazing choppers. Some Offenbach gallop come jigging in now out of the loudspeakers that are implicit in this machine's design. Long gartered legs kicking out over the agony of this sad, spherical, permanent AWOL. All his companions in the chute vibrating their concern and love, feeling his pain but helpless. Inert without the spring, the hustler's hand, the drunk's masculinity problems, the vacuum hours of a gray cap and an empty lunchbox, needing these to run their own patterns down the towering coils, the deep holes with their promises of rest that only kick you wobbling out again, always at the mercy of gravity, finding now and then the infinitesimally shallow grooves of other runs, great runs, 12 heroic minutes in Virginia Beach, 4th of July, 1927, a drunken sailor whose ship went down at Leyte Gulf. Flipped up off the board. Your first three-dimensional trip is always your best. When you came down again, it wasn't the same. and every time you'd pass anywhere near the micro dimple you made when you fell, you'd get a rush. Sobered, a few, having looked into the heart of the solenoid, seen the magnetic serpent and energy in its nakedness, long enough to be changed, to bring back from the writhing lines of force down in that pit an intimacy with power, with glazed bad lands of soul that set them apart forever. Check out the portrait of Michael Faraday in the Tate Gallery in London. Aunt Ivy Mucker Maffick did once, to fill up a womanless and dreary afternoon, and wondered then how eyes of men could grow so lambent, sinister, so educated among the halls of dread and the invisible. But now the voices of the murder witness coquettes grow shrill, with more of a blade's edge, the music changes key, pitching higher and higher, the ruffled buttocks bumping backward more violently, the skirts flipping redder and deeper each time, covering more of the field, eddying to blood, to furnace finale. And how's the Kotchspiel kid going to get out of this one? Well, wouldn't you know it? Just as things look worst, Providence plants a short sta-ta-ta-ta. The lights go out, leaving a diminishing red glow on the shaven cheeks and chins of the two operators cringing before the girl's destroying cooch dance. The solenoid jitters to silence. The chrome ball released rolls traumatized back to the comfort of its friends. They're all like this? Oh, was I took, groans Alfonso Tracy. It comes and goes, consoles Bland. And here we get a reprise of Gerhard von Gerl's Bright Days for the Black Market, with allowances made for time, place, and color. There'll always be another dollar, any way it happens. If they catch you napping, wake up with the dew on the grass, and you can hand them their ass. You can make another dollar, third eye up on that pyramid. Oh, give a listen, kid, it's just winking at you, singing piss on through. There's a will, there's a way. Doesn't happen every day. But if you got the brains, those midnight trains will never whistle your dreams away. Hey, just flip another dollar. Heads or tails, it'll be all right. You can lose the fight, but that ever-loving war goes on and on, you know. Just follow that dollar and vote-o-dodo. All the baggy pants, outfielders, doughboys in khaki, can-can girls now sedate, bathing beauties even more so, cowboys and cigar store Indians, Google-eyed Negroes, apple cart urchins, lounge lizards and movie queens, card sharps, clowns, cross-eyed lamppost drunks, flying aces, motorboat captains, white hunters on safari and Negroid apes, fat men, chefs in chef's hats, Jewish usurers, 3X jug-clutching hillbillies, comic book cats, dogs, and mice, prize fighters and mountaineers, radio stars, midgets, 10-in-1 freaks, railroad hobos, marathon dancers, swing bands, high society partygoers, racehorses and jockeys, taxi dancers, Indianapolis drivers, sailors ashore, and wahinas in hula skirts, sinewed Olympic runners, tycoons holding big round bags with dollar signs, all join in on a second grand chorus of the song, all the boards of the pinball machines flashing on and off, primary colors with a touch of acid to them, flippers flipping, bells ringing, nickels pouring out of the coin boxes of the more enthusiastic, each sound and move exactly in its place in the complex ensemble. Outside the temple, the organization reps from Chicago lurk, play Mora, drink Canadian blends out of silver hip flasks, oil and clean 38s, and generally carry on in their loathsome ethnic way, popish inscrutability in every sharp crease and shadowy jowl. No way to tell if someplace in the wood file cabinets exists a set of real blueprints telling exactly how all these pinball machines were rewired. A randomness deliberately simulated. Of if it has happened at real random, preserving at least our faith in malfunction as still something beyond their grasp. A faith that each machine, individually, has simply, in innocence, gone on the blink. After the thousands of roadhouse nights, end-of-the-world Wyoming thunderstorms that come straight down on your hatless head, truck-stop amphetamines, tobacco smoke clawing at insides of eyelids, homicidal grabs after some way out of the year's never-slackening shit, have players forever strangers brought about separately, alone, each of these bum machines? Believe it, they've sweated, kicked, cried, smashed, lost their balance forever. A single mobility you never heard, a unity unaware of itself, a silence the encyclopedia histories have blandly filled up with agencies, initials, spokesmen, and deficits enough to keep us from finding them again. But for the moment, through the elaborate theatrical foofaraw of mob and masons, it has concentrated here in the back of the mouth organ temple an elegant chaos to bend the ingenuity of Bland's bought expert, silver-streaking Bert Feibel. Last we saw of Feibel, he was hooking, stretching, and running shock cord for that Horst Achtfaden back in his gliding days. Feibel, who stayed on the ground and saw his friend on to Peenemünde, saw him on? Isn't that a slice of surplus paranoia there? Not quite justified, is it? Well, call it toward a case for Bland's involvement with Achtfaden, too, if you want. Feibel worked for Siemens back when it was still part of the Stinnes Trust. Along with his design work, he also put in some time as a Stinnes intelligence agent. There are also still loyalties to Vereinigte Stahlwerke in effect, though Feibel happens to be working now at the General Electric plant in Pittsfield, Massachusetts. It's in Bland's interest to have an agent in the Berkshires. Can you guess why? Yep, to keep an eye on adolescent Tyrone Slothrop is why. Nearly 10 years after the original deal was closed, I.G. Farben is still finding it easier to subcontract the surveillance of young Tyrone back to Lyle Bland. This stone-faced Krautfeibel is a genius with solenoids and switches. How all this machinery got out of the glue, as they say over there, is a sinful waste of time even to think about. He dives into topologies and color codes. The odor of rosin flux goes seeping into the pool rooms and saloons. A schnipsel here and there, a muttered also or two, and before you know it, he's got most of them working again. You can bet there's a lot of happy masons in Mouth Organ, Missouri. In return for his good deed, Lyle Bland, who couldn't care less, is made a mason. He finds good fellowship, all kinds of comfort designed to remind him of his virility, and even a number of useful business contacts. Beyond this, all is just as tight as that business advisory council. Non-masons stay pretty much in the dark about what goes on, though now and then something jumps out, exposes itself, jumps giggling back again, leaving you with few details but a lot of awful suspicions. Some of the American founding fathers were masons, for instance. There is a theory going around that the USA was, and still is, a gigantic Masonic plot under the ultimate control of the group known as the Illuminati. It is difficult to look for long at the strange single eye crowning the pyramid which is found on every dollar bill and not begin to believe the story. A little. Too many anarchists in 19th century Europe, Bakunin, Proudhon, Salverio Frisia, were masons for it to be pure chance. Lovers of global conspiracy, not all of them Catholic, can count on the masons for a few good shivers and voids when all else fails. One of the best of the classic weird mason stories has Dr. Livingstone, oh yes, come wandering into a native village in not even the heart but the subconscious of darkest Africa, a place, a tribe he's never seen before. Fires in the silence, unfathomable stares. Livingstone ambles up to the village chief and flashes him a Masonic high sign. The chief recognizes it, returns it, all smiles, and orders every fraternal hospitality laid on for the white stranger. But recall that Dr. Livingstone, like Werner von Braun, was born close to the spring equinox, and so had to confront the world from that most singular of the zodiac's singular points. Well, and keep in mind where those Masonic mysteries came from in the first place. Check out Ishmael Reed. He knows more about it than you'll ever find here. We must also never forget famous Missouri Mason Harry Truman. Sitting by virtue of death in office this every August 1945 with his control finger poised right on Miss Enola Gay's atomic clit, making ready to tickle 100,000 little yellow folks into what will come down as a fine vapor deposit of fat cracklings wrinkled into the fused rubble of their city on the inland sea. By the time Bland joined up, the Masons had long, long degenerated into just another businessman's club. A real shame. Business of all kinds over the centuries had atrophied certain sense receptors and areas of the human brain, so that for most of the fellows taking part, the present-day rituals were no more and even maybe a little less than hollow mummery. Not for all of them, though. Now and then you found a throwback. Lyle Bland happened to be one. The magic in these Masonic rituals is very, very old. And way back in those days it worked. As time went on and it started being used for spectacle to consolidate what were only secular appearances of power, it began to lose its zip. But the words, moves, and machinery have been more or less faithfully carried down over the millennia through the grim rationalizing of the world, and so the magic is still there, though latent, needing only to touch the right, sensitive head to reassert itself. Bland found himself coming home to Beacon Hill after meetings late at night, unable to sleep. He would lie down in his study on the Davenport, not thinking about anything in particular, and come back with a jolt, his heart pounding terribly, knowing he'd just been somewhere, but unable to account for the passage of time. The old American Empire clock beat in the resonant hallway. The Durandal mirror, passed on by generations of Blands, gathered images in its quicksilver pool that Lyle couldn't bring himself to face. In another room, his wife, varicose and religious, groaned in her sleep. What was happening to him? Next meeting night, home on his back on the accustomed Davenport, Wall Street Journal with nothing in it he didn't already know, Lyle Bland rose up out of his body, about a foot, face up, realized where he was, and gah, whoosh, back in again. He lay there more terrified than he'd ever been, even at Belleau Wood. Not so much because he'd left his body, but because he knew that this was only a first step. The next step would be to roll over in midair and look back. Old magic had found him. He was off on a journey. He knew he couldn't keep from going on with it. It took him a month or two before he could make the turn. When it happened, he felt it as a turn not so much in space as in his own history. Irreversible. The Bland who came back to rejoin the inert white container he'd seen belly up on the sofa thousands of years beneath him had changed forever. Before very long, he was spending most of his time on that Davenport, and hardly any at all down on State Street. His wife, who never questioned anything, moved vaguely through the rooms, discussing only household affairs, sometimes getting an answer if Bland happened to be inside his body, but most often not. Odd-looking people began to show up at the door, without phoning. Creeps, foreigners with tinted oily skin, wens, styes, cysts, wheezes, bad teeth, limps, staring, or worse, with strange, faraway smiles. She let them in the house, all of them, and the study doors were closed gently behind them, in her face. She could hear nothing but a murmur of voices in what she guessed to be some foreign tongue. They were instructing her husband in techniques of voyage. There have happened, though rarely, in geographical space, journeys taken northward on very blue, fire-blue seas, chilled, crowded by floes, to the final walls of ice. Our judgment lapsed fatally. We paid more attention to the Peary's and Nansen's who returned, and worse, we named what they did success, though they failed. Because they came back to fame, to praise, they failed. We only wept for Sir John Franklin, and Salomon André, mourned their cairns and bones and missed among the poor frozen rubbish the announcements of their victory. By the time we had the technology to make such voyages easy, we had long worded over all ability to know victory or defeat. What did André find in the polar silence? What should we have heard? Bland, still an apprentice, hadn't yet shaken off his fondness for hallucinating. He knows where he is when he's there, but when he comes back, he imagines that he has been journeying underneath history, that history is Earth's mind, and that there are layers set very deep, layers of history analogous to layers of coal and oil in Earth's body. The foreigners sit in his parlor, hissing over him, leaving offensive films of sebum on everything they touch, trying to see him through this phase, clearly impatient with what they feel are the tastes of a loafer and vulgarian. He comes back raving about the presences he has found out there, members of an astral IG whose mission, as indeed Rathenau implied through the medium of Peter Saxa, is past secular good and evil. Distinctions like that are meaningless out there. Yes, yes, all staring at him. But then why keep saying mind and body? Why make that distinction? Because it's hard to get over the wonder of finding that Earth is a living critter. After all these years of thinking about a big dumb rock to find a body and psyche, he feels like a child again. He knows that in theory he must not attach himself, but still he is in love with his sense of wonder, with having found it again, even this late, even knowing he must soon let it go, to find that gravity, taken so for granted, is really something eerie, messianic, extrasensory in Earth's mind-body, having hugged to its holy center the wastes of dead species gathered, packed, transmuted, realigned, and rewoven molecules to be taken up again by the coal-tar Kabbalists of the other side, the ones Bland on his voyages has noted, taken boiled off, teased apart, explicated to every last permutation of useful magic. Centuries past exhaustion, still finding new molecular pieces, combining and recombining them into new synthetics. Forget them. They are no better than the Klipoth, the shells of the dead. You must not waste your time with them. The rest of us, not chosen for enlightenment, left on the outside of Earth, at the mercy of a gravity we have only begun to learn how to detect and measure, must go on blundering inside our front brain faith in cute correspondences, hoping that for each psi synthetic taken from Earth's soul, there is a molecule, secular, more or less ordinary and named, over here, kicking endlessly among the plastic trivia, finding in each deeper significance and trying to string them all together like terms of a power series, hoping to zero in on the tremendous and secret function whose name, like the permuted names of God, cannot be spoken. Plastic saxophone reed, sounds of unnatural timbre, shampoo bottle ego image, crackerjack prize, one-shot amusement, home appliance casing, fairing for winds of cognition, baby bottles, tranquilization, meat packages, disguise of slaughter, dry cleaning bags, infant strangulation, garden hoses, feeding endlessly the desert. But to bring them together, in their slick persistence and our preterition, to make sense out of, to find the meanest sharp sliver of truth in so much replication, so much waste. Lucky Bland to be free of it. One night he called his whole family together around the davenport in the study. Lyle Jr. came in from Houston, shivering with first-stage grip from contact with a world where air conditioning is not so essential to life. Clara drove down from Bennington, and Buddy rode the MTA in from Cambridge. "As you know," Bland announced, "I have been taking these little trips lately." He was wearing a simple white smock and holding a red rose. He looked unearthly. All were later to agree. His skin and eyes had a clarity which is seldom encountered, except on certain spring days at certain latitudes just before sunrise. "I have found," he continued, "that each time out I have been traveling farther and farther. Tonight I am going out for good. That is, I am not coming back. So I wanted to say goodbye to you all and let you know that you'll be provided for." He'd been to see his friend Coolidge, hot short of the State Street law firm of Salitieri, Poor, Nash, De Brutus, and Short, and made sure all the family finances were in perfect order. "I want you to know that I love you all. I'd stay here if I could, but I have to go. I hope you can understand." One by one, his family came up to say goodbye. Hugs, kisses, handshakes done, Bland sank back into that Davenport's last embrace, closed his eyes with a dim smile. After a bit, he felt himself beginning to rise. Those watching disagreed about the exact moment. Around 9:30, Buddy left to see the Bride of Frankenstein, and Mrs. Bland covered the serene face with a dusty chintz drape she'd received from a cousin who had never understood her taste. A windy night. The lids of GI cans blow clanging across the parade ground. Sentries in their idleness are practicing Queen Anne salutes. Sometimes gusts of wind come that rock the jeeps on their springs. Even the empty deuce-and-a-halves and civilian bobtail rigs, shock absorbers groan deeply in discomfort. In the peaks of wind, living pine trees move, lined above the last sand drop-off into the North Sea. Walking at a brisk pace, but out of step, across the lorry-scarred spaces of the old Krupp works here, Doctors Muffage and Spontoon look anything but conspiratorial. You take them immediately for what they seem, a tiny beachhead of London respectability here in benighted Cuxhaven. Tourists in this semi-civilized colony of sulfur shaken into the wells of blood, cirettes, and tourniquets. Junky M.O.s and sadistic corpsmen, a colony they were spared for the duration, thank heaven, Muffage's brother being highly placed in a certain ministry, Spontoon having been technically disqualified because of a strange hysterical stigma, shaped like the Ace of Spades, and nearly the same color, which would appear on his left cheek at moments of high stress accompanied by severe migraine. Only a few months ago, they felt themselves fully mobilized as any British civilian and thus amenable to most government requests. About the present mission, though, both now are deep in peacetime second thoughts. How quickly history passes these days. "I can't think why he asked us," Muffage, stroking his full imperial, a gesture that manages only to look compulsive, speaking in a voice perhaps too melodious for a man of his mass. "He must know I haven't done one of these since 27. "I assisted at a few whilst I was interning," Spontoon recalls. "That was during the great vogue they had at mental institutions, you know."
"I can name you a few national institutions where it's still in vogue."
The medicos share a chuckle full of that British Weltschmerz that looks so uncomfortable on the faces of the afflicted.
"See here, then, Spontoon. You'd rather assist me, is that it?"
"Oh, either way, you know. I mean, it's not as if there'd be some chap with a book standing there, you know, writing it all down."
"I wouldn't be too sure. Weren't you listening? Didn't you notice anything?"
"Enthusiastic."
"Obsessional. I wonder if Pointsman isn't losing his grip."
Sounding here remarkably like James Mason.
"Losing?
his grip. They are looking at each other now, separate nightscapes of Marston shelters and parked vehicles flowing darkly by together behind each face. The wind carries smells of brine, of beach, of petrol. A distant radio tuned to the General Forces program features Sandy McPherson at the organ. "Oh, all of us," Spontoon begins, but lets it lapse. "Here we are." The bright office is hung with crimson-lipped, sausage-limbed, petty girl pinups. A coffee mess hisses in the corner. There's also a smell of rancid chew dubbing. A corporal sits with his feet on a desk, absorbed in an American Bugs Bunny comic book. "Slothrop," in answer to Muffage's inquiry. "Yes, yes, the Yank in the pig suit. Well, he's in and out all the time, completely dotty. What are you lot, then? MI6 or something?" "Can't discuss it," raps Spontoon. Fancies himself a bit of a Nayland Smith, Spontoon does. "You know where we might find a General Wyvern?" "This time of night, down at the alcohol dump, most likely. Follow the tracks, head for all the noise. If I weren't on duty, I'd be there myself." "Pig suit," frowns Muffage. "Big, bloody pig suit. Yellow, pink, and blue, on my oath," replies the corporal. "You'll know him when you see him. You wouldn't have a cigarette, one of you gentlemen, by any chance?" Sounds of carousing reach them as they trudge along the tracks, past empty triple flats and tank cars. Alcohol dump. Fuel for their Nazi rockets, I'm told, if they ever get one in working order. Under a cold umbrella of naked light bulbs are gathered a crowd of army personnel, American sailors, Nafi girls, and German Fräuleins. Fraternizing every last one of them, shamefully, amid noise which becomes, as Muffage and Spontoon reach the edge of the gathering, a song at whose center, with a good snootful, each arm circling a smiling and disheveled young pussy, ruddy face under these lights gone an apoplectic mauve, and leading the glee, is the same General Wyvern they last saw in Pointsman's office back at 12th House. From a tank car whose contents, ethanol, 75% solution, are announced in stark white stenciling along the side, spigots protrude here and there, under which an incredible number of mess cups, china mugs, coffee pots, waste baskets, and other containers are being advanced and withdrawn. Ukuleles, kazoos, harmonicas, and any number of makeshift metal noisemakers accompany the song, which is an innocent salute to post-war, a hope that the end of shortages, the end of austerity, is near. It's mouth-tripping time, mouth-tripping time, time to open up that icebox door. Oh, yes, it's mouth-tripping time, mouth-tripping time, and once you've eaten some, you'll come for more. Ah, mouth-tripping time, mouth-tripping time, it's something old but also very new. Life's so sublime in mouth-tripping time. We hope you're all mouth-tripping, too. Next chorus is soldiers and sailors all together for the first 8 bars, girls for the second, General Wyvern singing the next 8 solo, and Tutti to finish it up. Then comes a chorus for ukuleles and kazoos and so on, while everyone dances, black neckerchiefs whipping about like the mustaches of epileptic villains, delicate snoods unloosening to allow stray locks of hair to escape their tight rolls, skirt hems raised to expose flashing knees, and slips edged in pre-war Clooney lace, a frail flight of smoky bat wings here under the white electricity. On the final chorus, the boys circle clockwise, girls anticlockwise, the ensemble opening out into a rose pattern, from the middle of which dissipatedly leering tosspot General Wyvern tankard aloft is hoisted briefly like an erect stamen. About the only one not participating here, aside from the 2 prowling surgeons, is Seaman Bodine, whom we left, you recall, carrying on in the bathtub at Zoyre Boomer's place back in Berlin. Impeccable tonight in dress whites, straight-faced and sober, he trudges among the merrymakers, thickly sprouting hair from jumper sleeves and v-neck, so much of it that last week he spooked and lost a connection just in from the CBI theater with close to a ton of bong, who mistook him for a seagoing version of the legendary Yeti or Abominable Snowman. To make up some of what he blew on that one, Bodine is tonight promoting the first international Runcible spoon fight between his shipmate Avery Purfle and an English commando named St. John Blattery. "Place your bets. Yes, yes, the odds are even, 50-50, announces suave croupier Bodine, pushing through the gathered bodies, many of them far from upright, one shaggy hand clutching a wad of occupation scrip. With the other, from time to time, he will tug the big collar of his jumper around and blow his nose on it, grommets on the hem of his T-shirt blinking, light bulbs dancing overhead in the wind he's raised, his own several shadows thrashing in all directions and merging with others. "Greetings, gate. Need an opiate?" Tiny red eyes and a vast pink jello of a face and an avaricious smile. It is Albert Krypton,
Corman Stryker of the USS John E. Badass, who now produces from inside a secret jumper pocket a glass vial full of white tablets. Codeine, Jackson, it's beautiful. Here. Codeine sneezes violently and wipes the snot away with his sleeve. Not for any fucking cold, Krypton, thanks. You seen Avery? He's in great shape. He was getting in some last-minute practice down the goat hole when I came over. Listen, old buddy, begins the enterprising Tar. This decrypts into 3 ounces of cocaine. Bodine comes up with a few squashed notes. Midnight, if he can. Told him I'd see him out at Pussy's after the fight. Solid. Hey, you checked under the barracks lately? Seems the CBI returnees get together to marbles with opium balls. You can pick up hundreds if you're any good. Corman Krypton pockets his money and leaves Bodine flexing his thumb and think about it, moves on copping fields, pausing to drink from a shell case of grain alcohol and grapefruit juice whilst dealing the odd tablet of codeine. He has a brief paranoid episode as 2 red-hatted MPs show up, stroking their billy clubs and giving him, he fancies, pregnant looks. He slides into the night, peeling away, banking through dark sky. He is coming on to a proprietary mixture known as the Krypton Blue, and so it is a giddy passage to the dispensary, not without moments of deep inattention. Inside, his connection, pharmacist Birdberry, is conducting the last act of La Forza del Destino, crackling in from Radio Luxembourg and singing along. His mouth snaps shut as Krypton comes taxiing in. With him is what appears to be a gigantic, multicolored pig. The plush nap of its coat reversed here and there, which widens the possible range of colors. Micrograms, Krypton striking his head dramatically. That's right, micrograms, not milligrams. Birdberry, give me something, I've OD'd. Shh. The dispenser's high forehead wrinkling in and out of operatical cross furrows. Krypton goes back in among the shelves and watches the lighted room through a bottle of paregoric till the opera's over. Comes back in time to hear the pig asking, well, where else would he head for? I got a third hand, Birdberry laying down the hypodermic he's been using as a baton. Ask Krypton here. He gets around a bit. Greetings, Gate, says Albert. Let's inoculate. I hear Springer is supposed to be coming in tonight. First I've heard, but go on out to Putsy's, why don't you? That's where all that sort of thing goes on. The pig looks up at a clock on the wall. Got a funny schedule tonight is all. Look here, Krypton, there's a bigwig from Spog due in here any moment, so whatever it was, you know... They haggle over the 3 ounces of cocaine, the pig politely withdrawing to leaf through an old News of the World. Presently, taping the last of the crystal-stuffed bottles to his bare leg, Krypton invites everyone to the Runcible spoon fight. Bodine's holding some big money, folks in from all over the zone. Seaman Bodine? Inquires the amazed plush pig. The king of Cuxhaven, Porky. Well, I ran him an errand once in Berlin. Tell him Rocket Man says howdy. Krypton, bell-bottom pulled up, opening one bottle just to see what he has, pauses, goggling. You mean that hash? Yep. Krypton snuffs a big fingerful of the flaky white into nostrils right and left. The world goes clarifying. Bitter snot begins to form in a stubborn fist at the back of his throat. Already the Potsdam pickup is part of the folklore of the zone. Would this pig here be trying to cash in on the glory of Rocket Man, whose existence Krypton has never been that sure of? Cocaine suspicions, cringing and mean as rats, shining bottles of 1,000 colors, voices from the radio, the drape and hand of the pig's shag coat as Krypton reaches out to stroke. No, it's clear that the pig isn't looking for anything, isn't a cop, isn't dealing or about to hustle anybody. Just wanted to see how it felt, you know, says Krypton. Sure. Now the doorway is suddenly full of red hats, leather and brass. Krypton stands very still, the top to the open cocaine bottle in one hand. Slothrop, sergeant in command, comes edging into the room, hand resting on his sidearm. The pig looks over at Birdberry, who's shaking his head, no, not me, as if he means it. Wasn't me either, Krypton feels he ought to mention. Well, somebody blew the whistle, the pig mutters, looking really hurt. Stand by, whispers Albert to the MP. Excuse me, moseying straight over to wall switch, which he flicks off. Slothrop at once dashing through all the shouting past Birdberry's desk, wham into a tall rack of medicines his straw stomach bounces him off of, but which then falls over on somebody else with a stupendous glass crash and scream, on down a pitch-black aisle, arms out to guide him to the back exit where he meets Krypton. Thanks. Quick. Outside, they cut eastward toward the Elbe and the docks, pounding along, skidding in mud puddles, stumbling over lorry ruts, wind sweeping among the Quonsets to bat them in the face, cocaine falling in little white splashes from underneath Krypton's left bell-bottom. Behind them, the posse are hollering and shining flashlights, but don't seem to know where they've gone. Good.
Follow the yellow brick road, hums Albert Krypton on pitch. Follow the yellow brick road. What's this? Is he actually... Yes, he's skipping. Presently, out of breath, they arrive at the pier where the badass and its division, four haze-gray piglets, are tied up to find the Runcible spoon fight just underway at the center of a weaving, cheering crowd of civilian and military drunks. Stringy Avery Purfle, sideburns slick as seal's fur in the pallid light, Adam's apple working in and out at a nervous 4 or 5 cycles a minute, shuffles around his opponent, the serene and ox-like St. Jattery, both with Runcible spoons in the on-guard pizzled edges bright. Krypton stashes Slothrop in a garbage bin and goes looking for Seaman Bodine. After a number of short, glittering feints, Purfle dodges in, quick as a fighting cock. With a high slash that Blattery tries to parry in third, Purfle rips through the commando's blouse and draws blood. But when he goes to jump back, it seems thoughtful Blattery has brought his combat boot down on the American's low dress shoe, nailing him where he stands. Promoter Bodine and his two combatants are burning crystals of awareness in this poisoned gray gathering. A good half of the crowd are out in the foothills of unconsciousness, and the rest are not exactly sure what's going on. Some think that Purfle and Blattery are really mad at each other. Others feel that it is meant at inappropriate moments. Now and then, the odd, beady eyes will appear up in the night superstructures of the warships, staring, staring. Purfle and Blattery have made simultaneous thrusts and are now corps à corps. With a scrape and clank, the Runcible spoons are locked. Shift for trickery, since Blattery is ready to hold the position all night. Here, Krypton tugging at both pig suit. Not now. But the heat's after him. Who cares? Its asshole is all a fake. Rocket Man wouldn't be here. Purfle yanks his Runcible spoon hand backing to the side, twisting his own weapon to keep its tines interlocked with those of Blattery's. Pulling the commando off balance long enough to release his own foot, deftly unlinking the spoons and away. Blattery recovers his footing and moves heavily in pursuit, probing in with a series of jabs, then shifting the spoon to his other hand and surprising Purfle with a slash that grazes the sailor's neck, missing the jugular but not by much. Blood drips into the white jumper, black under these arc lights. Sweat and cold shadows lie darkly in the men's armpits. Purfle, made reckless by the pain, goes flying at Blattery, a flurry of blind, wild pokes and hackings. Blattery, hardly needing to move his feet, weaving from the knees up like a great, assured pudding, finally able to grab Purfle's spoon hand at the wrist and twirl him about like jitterbugging a girl around in front of him, his own knife edge now up and bisecting Purfle's Adam's apple, ready to slice him. He looks up, around, wheezing, sweaty, seeking some locus of power that will signal him what to do. Nothing. Only vomiting, shivering, a ghost and flowered odor of ethanol, solid Bodine counting his money, nobody really watching. It then comes to Blattery and Purfle at once, tuned to one another the filed edge of this rune and the negligible effort it will take to fill their common world with nobody said anything about a fight to the finish, right? That each will get part of the purse whoever wins. And so the sensible course is to break it up now, jointly to go hassle Bodine and find some band-aids and iodine. And still they linger in their embrace, death in all its potency, humming them romantic tunes, chiding them for moderate little men. So far and no farther, is that it? You call that living? An MP car, horn and siren and lights all going, approaches. Reluctantly, Purfle and Blattery do relax and, sighing out of puffed cheeks, part. Bodine, 10 feet ahead of the awakening crowd, a fat packet of script which the commando catches, riffle splits, and gives half of to Purfle, who's already en route gangplank of his gray mother, the John E. Badass. With her deck watch, are looking more lively, and even a card game in the ship's laundry breaking up so everybody can go watch the big bust. Drunkards ashore begin to mill, sluggish and with no sense of direction. From beyond the pale of electric light comes a rush of girls, shivering, aroused, beruffled, to which St. John Battery away under cover of pretty pastel synthetics and amorous squeals. Bodine and Krypton, hip crowd stumbling over wakers and sleepers, stop by the dumpster to collect Slothrop, who rises from a pile of eggshells, bends horrible chicken parts in yellow gravy, coffee grounds, and waste paper spilling or clattering off of him, raises a mask and smiles howdy at Bodine.
Rocket Man, holy shit, it really is. What's an old buddy?
Been double-crossed. Need a ride to Putsy's. Lorries have been showing up. Into shadows, MPs are beginning to load everybody slower moving than they. Now two civilians, one with a beard, come charging down the pier, hollering, a pig suit there, and you, Slothrop, stay where you are. Not out to, Slothrop, with a great clank and crunch, rolls out of the gosh, and at a dead run, Bodine and Krypton, chicken fat flowing away, eggshells flying off behind him. A Red Cross clubmobile or canteen truck is parked down at the next nest of destroyers, its light spilling neatly square on the asphalt, a pretty girl with a Diana Durbin hairdo framed inside against stacks of cigarettes, chalk-shaped sandwiches, and waxed paper.
Coffee, boys? She smiles. How about some sandwiches? We're sold out of everything tonight but ham. Then seeing Slothrop, oh dear, I'm sorry. Key to the truck. Bodine coming up with a Cagney sneer and nickel-plated handgun. Come on! Cocking the hammer. Tough frown, shoulder-padded shrug. In the ignition, Jackson. Albert Krypton climbs in the back to Slothrop and Bodine jump in front and get underway in a tight, screeching U-turn just as two civilians come running up. Now who the hell's that? Slothrop looking back out the window at their shouting shapes diminishing. Did you check that one bird with the ace of spades on his cheek? Bodine swerves past the disturbance around the Johnny badass and gives everybody the obligatory finger. Slothrop slouches back in the seat, putting the pig mask up like a night's beaver, reaching over to pick a cigarette out of Bodine's jumper pocket, lighting one up, weary, wishing he could just sleep. In back of him, suddenly the Red Cross girl shrieks, My God, what's that? Look, Krypton, patiently, you get some on the end of your finger, right? And then you close off one head of your nose, and... It's cocaine, the girl's voice rising to an alarming intensity. Is what it is. It's heroin. You're dope fiends, and you've kidnapped me. Oh, my God, this is a... Don't you realize it's a Red Cross clubmobile? It's the property of the Red Cross. Oh, you can't do this. I'm with the Red Cross. Oh, help me, somebody. They're dope fiends. Oh, please help. Stop and let me out. Take that if you want. Take everything in it, but oh, please don't...
Steer a minute. Bodine turning around and pointing his shiny pistol at the girl.
You can't shoot me, she screams. You hoodlum, who do you think you are? Hijacking Red Cross property. Why don't you just go somewhere and sniff your dope and leave us alone?
Cunt, advises Seaman Bodine in a calm and reasonable tone. You are wrong. I can shoot you, right? Now, you happen to be working for the same warm and wonderful organization that was charging 15 cents for coffee and donuts at the Battle of the Fucking Bulge, if you really want to get into who is stealing what from who.
Whom?
She replies in a much smaller voice, lower lip quivering, kind of cute and bitchy, it seems, to Slothrop, checking it out in the rearview mirror as Bodine takes over the wheel again. Oh-ho, this, Krypton watching her ass. What have we here? Shifting under its cocky skirt as she stands with long legs braced for their rattling, creaking 70 miles an hour and Bodine's strange cornering techniques, which look to be some stylized form of suicide. What's your name? Slothrop smiling, an avuncular pig.
Shirley.
Tyrone, howdy. Tra-la-la, Krypton now looting the cash register, gobbling Hershey bars and stuffing his socks with packs of smokes. Love and bloom. About then, Bodine slams on the brakes and goes into a great skid, ass end of their truck slewing toward an icy-lit tableau of sentries in white stenciled helmet liners, belts, white holsters, a barricade across the road, an officer running toward a jeep hunched up and hollering into a walkie-talkie. Roadblock? What the shit? Bodine grinding it into reverse, various goodies for the troops crashing off of their shelves as the truck lurches around. Shirley loses her footing and staggers forward, Krypton grabbing for her as Slothrop leans to take the handgun off the dashboard, finding her half-draped over the front seat when he gets back around to the window. Where the fuck is Lowe now? What is it, a Red Cross gearbox? You got to put a nickel in someplace to get it in gear, hey, Shirley?
Oh, goodness.
Shirley squirming over into the front between them, grabbing the shift.
Like this, you drip.
Gunshots behind them. Thank you, says Bodine, and leaving rubber in a pungent smoking shriek, they're off again. You're really hot, Rocket Man. Wow. Krypton lying in back, offering ankle and taped cocaine bottle to Shirley with a smile. Do tell.
No thanks, says Shirley. I'd really better not.
Come on. Aw. Were those snowdrops back there? Slothrop squinting into the lampshine ahead. GIs? What are GIs doing here in the British sector, do you know? Maybe not, Bodine guesses. Maybe only shore patrol. Come on, let's not get any more paranoid than we have to. Look, see, I'm doing snuff it, and I'm not growing snuff fangs or anything. Well, I just... Shirley kneeling backwards, breasts propped on the back of the seat, one big smooth country girl hand on Slothrop's shoulder for balance. Look, Bodine says, is it currency or dope or what? I'd just like to know what to expect, because if the heat's on... Only me, far as I know, there is nothing to do with dealing. It's a whole different drill. She's the rose of nomad land, sings Albert Krypton, coaxing. Why are you going to Putsy's? Got to see that Springer. Didn't know he was coming in. Why does everybody keep saying that?
Remember now.
Shirley talking with only one nostril here.
Not too much, Albert, just a teensy bit.
Just that nobody's seen him for a while. Be inhaling now. Good. Okay. Now. There's a little still kind of a booger that's blocking it. Do it again. Right. Now the other one.
Albert, you said only one.
Look, Rocky, if you do get busted, don't want to think.
Jeepers, says Shirley.
You like that? Here, just do a little more. What did you do? Nothing. Wanted to talk to somebody. Spog. Find out what was happening. We were just supposed to talk, you know, off the record. Tonight in the dispensary. Neutral ground. Instead, the man shows up. Now, there are also these other two creeps and civvies.
You a spy or something? Wish I was even that. Oh, boy, I should have known better. Well, it sounds pretty bad. And Seaman Bodine drives along, not liking it much, brooding, growing sentimental. Say, presently, if they do, well, catch up with you. I could get in touch with your mom. A sharp look. No, no, no. Well, somebody. Can't think of a soul. Wow, Rocket Man. Putsies turns out to be a sprawling, half-fortified manor house dating from the last century, off the Durham Road and seaward down a sandy pair of wheel tracks with reeds and tough dune grass growing in between. The house perched like a raft atop a giant comber of a sandhill that sweeps upward from a beach whose grade is so subtle that it becomes water only by surprise, tranquil, salt pale, stretching miles into the North Sea like clouds, here and there more silver, long cell or skin shapes, tissue-thin, stilled under the moon, reaching out toward Helgoland. The place never got requisitioned. Nobody has ever seen the owner or even knows if Putsy is anybody real. Bodine drives the truck right on into what used to be the stable, and they all get out, surely hurrahing in the moonlight, Krypton mumbling, oh boy, through big mouthfuls of that frau bait. There is some password and security hassle at the door on account of the pig getup, but Slothrop flashes his white plastic knight, and that's... Inside, they find a brightly lit and busy combination bar, opium den, cabaret, casino, and house of ill repute. All its rooms, swarming soldiers, sailors, dames, tricks, winners, losers, conjurers, dealers, dopers, voyeurs, homosexuals, fetishists, spies, and folks just looking for company. All talking, singing, or raising hell at a noise level, the house's silent walls seal off completely from the outside. Perfume, smoke, alcohol, and sweat glide through the house in turbulences too gentle to feel or see. It's a floating celebration to adjourn, a victory party so permanent, so easy at gathering newcomer and old regular to itself that who can say for sure which victory, which war? Springer is nowhere in sight, and from what Slothrop can gather from random questioning won't be by till later, if at all. That happens to be the very delivery date for that discharge they arranged sailing in with Frau Knob to Stralsund. And tonight of all nights, after a week of not bothering him, the police decide to come after Slothrop. Oh, yes. Yes, indeed. Good evening, Tyrone Slothrop. We have been waiting for you. Of course we are here. You didn't think we had just faded away. No, no, Tyrone. We must hurt you again if you are going to be that stupid. Hurt you again and again. Yes, Tyrone, you are so hopeless, so stupid and doomed. Are you really supposed to find anything? What if it is death, Tyrone? What if we don't want you to find anything? If we don't want to give you your discharge, you'll just go on like this forever, won't you? Maybe want you only to keep on. You don't know, do you, Tyrone? What makes you think you can play as well as we can? You can't. You think you're good, but you're really shit, and we all know it. That is in your dossier. Laughter, humming. Bodine finds him sitting inside a coat closet, chewing on a velvet ear of his mask. You look bad, Rocky. This is Solange. She's a masseuse. She is smiling, quickly, a child brought to visit the weird pig in his cave. I'm sorry, I'm sorry. Let me take you down to the baths. The woman's voice, a soapy sponge already caressing at his troubles. It's very quiet, restful. I'll be around all night, Bodine says. I'll tell you if Springer shows. This is some kind of a plot, right? Slothrop sucking saliva from velvet pile. Everything is some kind of a plot, man. Bodine laughing. And yes, but the arrows are pointing all different ways. Solange illustrating with a dance of hands red-pointed finger vectors. Which is Slothrop's first news out loud that the zone can sustain many other plots besides those polarized upon himself. That these are the L's and buses of an enormous transit system here in the Raketenstadt, more tangled even than Boston's. And that by riding each branch the proper distance, knowing when to transfer, keeping some state of minimum grace, though it might often look like he's headed the wrong way, this network of all plots may yet carry him to freedom. He understands that he should not be so paranoid of either Bodine or Solange, but ride instead their kind underground a while, see where it takes him. Solange leads Slothrop off to the baths, and Bodine continues to search for his customer, 2½ bottles of cocaine clinking and clammy against his bare stomach under his skivvy shirt. The Major isn't at any of the poker or crap games, nor attending the floor show, wherein one Yolanda, blonde and shining all over with baby oil, dances table to table picking up florin pieces and sovereigns, often hot from the flame of some joker's Zippo, between the prehensile lips of her cunt. Nor is he drinking, nor, according to Monica, Putsy's genial cigar-smoking, metal-assay-suited madam, is he screwing. He hasn't been by to hassle the piano player for San Antonio Rose.
It takes Bodine half an hour before colliding, reeling out the swinging doors of a pissoir, groggy from a confrontation with the notorious Eisenkröte, known throughout the zone as the ultimate test of manhood, before which bemedaled and breveted krautkillers, as well as the baddest shit-on-my-dick-or-blood-on-my-blade SKPs from the grossest of zonal stockades, all have been known to shrink, swoon, chicken out, and on occasion vomit, yes, right where they stood. For it is indeed an iron toad. Faithfully rendered, thousand-warted, and some say faintly smiling, a foot long at its longest, lurking at the bottom of a rank, shit-stained toilet and hooked up to the European grid through a rheostat control rigged to deliver varying, though not lethal, surges of voltage and current. No one knows who sits behind the secret rheostat. Some say it's the half-mythical Putzi himself, or if it isn't in fact hooked up to an automatic timer. For not everybody gets caught, really. You can piss on the toad without anything at all happening, but you just never know. Often enough to matter, the current will be there. Piranha raid and salmon climb up the gold-glittering fall of piss, your treacherous ladder of salts and acids, bringing you back into touch with Mother Ground, the great, the planetary pool of electrons making you one with your prototype, the legendary poor drunk, too drunk to know anything, pissing on some long-ago thill and fulminated to charcoal, to epileptic night, his screams not even his own, but the electricity's, the amps speaking through his already shattering vessel, shattered too soon for them even to begin to say it, voice their terrible release from silence. Nobody listening anyhow. Some watchman poking down the track, some old man unable to sleep out for a walk, some city drifter on a bench under a million June bugs and green nimble in the streetlight, his thing and tightening in and out of dreams, and maybe it was only a cat screwing. A church bell in a high wind, a window being broken, no direction to it, not even alarming. Swiftly by the old, the coal gas and Lysol silence. And somebody else finds him next morning. Or you can put these, if you're man enough, hiss on that toad. The major has got off this time with only a mild jolt and is in a titillating mood. Ugly sucker tried his best, wrapping an arm about Bodine's neck, but got his ass handed to him tonight, damn it. Got your snow, Major Marvey. Half a bottle shy. Sorry, it's the best I could do. That's all reach. I know so many know in here in Wiesbaden, you'd need 3 ton in that wooden legs a day. He pays them full price, overriding Bodine's offer to prorate for what's missing. Call it a little good, buddy. That's Dwayne Montangs. Damn, that old toad's got my pair of feeling pretty good now. If I die one of them little whores. Hey, where can I find me some pussy around here? This is how to get downstairs to the horse. They take you into a kind of private steam bath first. You can screw right there if you want. Doesn't cost any extra. Madam, hey, ha-ha, looks like kind of a dyke with that stogie in her face. Raises an eyebrow at Mo when he tells her he wants a nigger, but thinks she can get hold of one. It isn't the House of All Nations, but we do aim for variety. Running the tortoise end of her cigar holder down a call sheet. Sandra is engaged for the moment, an exhibition. In the meantime, here is our delightful Manuela to keep you company. Manuela is wearing only a high comb and black lace mantilla, shadow flowers falling to her hips, a professional smile for the fat American who is already fumbling with uniform buttons. Hubba, hubba. Hey, she's pretty sunburned herself, ain't ya? You got a little mulatto in there, a little Mexicano, honey? You sabe español? You sabe fucky fucky? Si, deciding tonight to be from the Levant. I am Spanish. I'm from Valencia. Valencia, sings Major Marvey to the well-known tune of the same name. Señorita Faki Faki Saki Saki 69, la 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 la. Dancing her in a brief two-step about the grave center of the waiting madam. Manuela doesn't feel obliged to join in. Valencia was one of the last cities to fall to Franco. She from the Asturias, which knew him first, felt his cruelty 2 years before the Civil War even began for the rest of Spain. She watches Marvey's face as he pays Monica, watches him in this primal American act, paying more deeply himself than when coming, or asleep, or maybe even dying. Marvey isn't her first, but almost her first, American. The clientele here at Putzi's is most British. During the war, how many camps and cities since her capture in 38? It was German. Missed the International Brigade, shut away up in her cold green mans and fighting hit-and-run long after the fascists had occupied all the North. Missed the flowers, children, kisses, and many tongues of Barcelona, of Valencia she's never been. Valencia, this evening's home. Ya salimos de España, pa luchar en otros frentes. Ay, Manuela. She hangs his gun neatly in a closet, and her trick into heat brightened the walls of the seething room. Feathered hairs along his legs, enormous buttocks and back beginning to come up dark with the dampness. Other souls move, sigh, groan, unseen among the sheets of fog. Dimensions in here under the earth meaningless. The room could be any size. An entire city's breadth, paved with birds not entirely gentle in twofold rotational symmetry, a foot darkened yellow and blue, the only colors to its watery twilight.
Ah, hot damn!
Marvy slithering fatly down, sleek with sweat, over the tiled edge into the scented water. His toenails, cut army square, slide under last.
Come on, everybody in the pool!
A great happy bellow, seizing Manuela's ankle and tugging. Having taken a fall or two on these tiles and seen a girlfriend go into traction, Manuela comes along gracefully, falling hard enough a straddle, bottom hitting his stomach a loud smack to hurt him, she hopes. But he only laughs again, loudly abandoned to the warmth and buoyancy and sounds encompassing anonymous fucking, drowsiness, ease, finds himself with a thick red hard on and slipped it without ado into the solemn girl half hidden inside her cloud of damp black Spanish lace, eyes any place but on his, a swing now through the interior fog, dreaming of home. Well, that's all reet. He isn't fucking her eyes, is he? He'd rather not have to look at her face anyhow. All he wants is the brown skin, the shut mouth, that sweet and nigger submissiveness. She'll do anything he orders. Yeah, he can hold her head under the water till she drowns. He can bend her hand back. Yeah, break her fingers like that cunt in Frankfurt the other week. Pistol whip. Bite till blood comes. Visions go swarming, violent, less erotic than you think, more occupied with thrust, impact, penetration, and such other military values. Which is not to say he isn't enjoying himself innocently, as you do, or that Manuela doesn't find herself, too, in some casual, athletic way, liking the ride up and down the stubborn red shaft of Major Marvy, though her mind is on a thousand other things now, a frock of Sandra's that she covets, words to various songs, an itch below her left shoulder blade, a tall English soldier she saw as she came through the bar around supper time, his brown forearm, shirt rolled to the elbow against the zinc top of the table. Voices in the steam. Alarms. Many feet clopping in shower shoes. Silhouettes moving by. A gaudy evacuation. What in the hell? Major Marvy about to come, riding on his elbows, distracted, squinting in several directions, rapidly getting a soft off. Raid! A voice going past. MPs! Shivers somebody else. Gah! Screams Major Marvy, who has just recalled the presence of 2.5 ounces of cocaine in his uniform pockets. He rolls, walrus heavy, Manuela sliding away and off his limpening, nervous penis, hardly aroused but enough of a professional to feel the price includes a token puto and sin vergüenza now. Scrambling up out of the water, skidding on the tiles, Duane Marvy, bringing up the rear, emerges into an ice-cold changing room to find the last of the bathers fled, the closets stone empty except for one multicolored velvet something or other. Hey, where's my uniform? Stomping on the floor, fists at his sides, face very red. Oh, you motherless bastards! Thereupon throwing several bottles and ashtrays, breaking two windows, attacking the wall with an ornate umbrella stand, feeling better for it in his mind. He hears combat boots in rooms nearby, girls screaming, a phonograph grid knocked screeching into silence. He checks out this plush or velvet rig, finds it to be a pig costume complete with mask, considers slyly that no MP would bother an innocent fun-seeking pig. As humorless, limey voices move closer through the rooms of pussies, he rips frantically at silk lining and straw padding to make room for his own fat. And, struggled at last inside, phew, zipped up, mask, hiding face, safe, clownish anonymous, pushes out through bead curtains, then upstairs to the bar, only to run spang into a full division of the red-hatted suckers coming his way, all in step, swear to God. "Here's our elusive swine, gentlemen," pocked face, blunt and ragged mustache, pointing a pistol right at his head, others moving up quickly. A civilian comes pushing through, spade shape blazing dark on his smooth cheek. Right, Dr. Muffridge is outside with the ambulance, and we'd like two of your chaps for a moment, Sergeant, till we're all secure.
Certainly, sir.
Wrists weak from steam and comfort gathered skillfully behind his back before he can even get mad enough to start yelling at them. Cold steel, ratcheting like a phone number being dialed late at night with no hope in hell of any answer ever. God damn! He finally gets out, mask muffling his voice, giving it an echo that hurts his ears.
What in the hell's wrong with you, boy? Don't you know who I am? But, uh-oh, wait a minute. If they found the uniform, Marvy ID, and cocaine in the same set of pockets, maybe it isn't such a hot idea to tell them his name just yet. Lieutenant Slothrop, we presume. Come along now. Slothrop, okay. We'll just wait. See what the score is. Square the dope thing later. Dumb. Say it must have been planted. Maybe even find him a Jewish lawyer good enough to nail the suckers for false arrest. He's escorted out the door and into the idling ambulance. The bearded driver gives him only a quick over-the-shoulder glance, then lets in the clutch. Before he can think to struggle, the other civilian and the MPs have quickly strapped Marvy at knees and chest to a stretcher. A pause by an army lorry to let the MPs off again. Then they continue on, toward Cuxhaven. Marvy thinks. Nothing but night. Moon-softened blindness out the window. Can't tell. Sedation now? Ace of Spades crouches beside him, shining a pocket flashlight over ampules in his kit, rattling syringes and points. Yes, we're almost there. I don't see why they couldn't have given us hospital space for this. The driver laughs. Oh, yes, I can just see that. Filling the hypodermic slowly. Well, we are under orders. I mean, there's nothing... Dear chap, it's not the most respectable operation. Hey, Major Marvy tries to raise his head. Operation? What's this, boy? Shh. Ripping away part of one pig suit sleeve, bearing Marvy's arm. I don't want no needle. But it's already in the vein, and discharging as the other man seeks to calm him. I mean, you really got the wrong fella, you know? Of course, Lieutenant. End of side 19. To continue, turn the cassette over.